This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today marks the 8th anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing, the first major terror attack on U.S. soil after 9/11. All of us here at Radio Boston are in solidarity with those who suffered as a result of that attack. 9/11 itself is also in our minds today. After President Biden announced he would withdraw all remaining troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021. It's not lost on anyone that that's 9/11's 20th anniversary. Former President Donald Trump had made conditional plans to withdraw the remaining U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the beginning of May. Here's Biden making his announcement from the Treaty Room yesterday, the same place President Bush outlined military strikes on Afghanistan in October 2001.
We cannot continue the cycle of extending or expanding our military presence in Afghanistan, hoping to create ideal conditions for the withdrawal and expecting a different result. I'm now the 4th United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a 5th.
It's a global plan with local implications. Boston has particular and painful roots in this 20-year war. It resonates so deeply with people from our communities who have served. Folks like Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He served in the Marine Corps, and he did 4 tours of duty in Iraq. We caught up with Moulton earlier this afternoon, and we began with his reaction to the withdrawal timeline.
I want to bring the troops home as much as anyone. But I want to make sure they can come home for good. And we've got to be really smart about how we do this, because if you remember what happened in Iraq is we withdrew and then had to turn around just a year later and put more troops back in to refight battles we had already won at the cost of more American lives. So I want to bring the troops home, and I'm glad that the president is working on that. But now we've got to talk about exactly what that looks like so we can get it right.
So explain for us what the similar or comparative risk of having to go back looks like here. What would cause that?
Well, first of all, it was a long time ago, 20 years now. But let's not forget why we went to Afghanistan. It was because terrorist training camps there helped the attacks of September 11th. And it's no mistake that, or I should say, it's not a coincidence that over the past 20 years, there hasn't been another 9/11 scale attack on the United States. Partly that's because of the work that our troops have been doing in Afghanistan and because of their sacrifices. So there remains the potential for a serious terrorist threat from the region. We also know that it's because of a base in Afghanistan that we were able to launch the raid in Pakistan against Osama bin Laden. And anyone who's actually spent any time on the ground in Afghanistan knows that it's a real blessing that Afghan girls are able to go to school now, millions of them, who never had that chance, not even that dream before America's presence. So for all the problems of the Afghan war, for all the mistakes that have been made, there are still a few narrow but compelling reasons to make sure we have some sort of continued presence, even if we withdraw the majority of our troops.
So there were 3 things in what you just said. There was a section about mission, there was a section about maintaining a presence, and there was a section about the people there. And I actually want to go to each one of those. You talked about our original mission 20 years ago. Did our mission change, whether that's the stated documented mission or the implied mission over time? Especially, why were members of our armed forces from our communities, for example, there after, say, Osama bin Laden was killed?
Yes, the mission did change, because originally we went there just to find and capture or kill the terrorists and those who supported them who attacked us on 9/11. And then we got into nation building. And many people recognized that we were doing a good thing in helping Afghanistan move away from the Taliban and their brutal, oppressive regime and give the Afghan people a chance at democracy. But of course, there's been a big debate about what America's role should really be in that endeavor. And I, for one, think we went too far. We took on too much with much too optimistic expectations for what we could honestly accomplish. That's certainly a mission that we have to scale back.
What makes you say that?
Well, I've been on the ground in Afghanistan. And I mean, look, if you really want to bring American-style democracy to Afghanistan, I think it's going to be a 50 or 100-year effort. And that's not what we've signed up for as the American people. What I want to see is America giving the Afghan government a chance so that girls can continue going to school, so that women have a place in government, and so that the Afghan people have some say in their democracy.
So it's like you're underscoring the rock and the hard place there, Congressman. The people there, that was another piece of this that I wanted to pull back out with you. You're talking about it there. So we've got this challenge, because you made the comparison to Iraq, where we wound up having to go back and there was great destabilization. We're not in it for 50 or 100 years. We've been in it 20 years. Is this an impossible proposition?
I don't think it's impossible, but it's hard. The one thing we've learned in the last 20 years is it's much harder to get out of these wars than it is to get into them. But let me paint a bad scenario, what we don't want to see happen. What we don't want to see is all the American troops withdraw, the Taliban immediately takes over. They ruin the lives of millions of Afghans, especially those girls who finally see a chance at having a bright future. And they also start setting up terrorist training camps again, with groups like ISIS that have an explicit intention of attacking the United States. I fear that if that happens, very shortly we'll see American troops going back in. And if they have to fight the same battles again to retake territory that we gave up, literally to just occupy bases that we could have simply maintained at the cost of no American lives, then I think we'll look back on that as a mistake. Tiziana, I want to bring the troops home too. I just want to make sure we do it responsibly to ensure our national security.
Do you believe that if we withdraw the remaining 2,500 troops by September 11th, 2021, that we are running too big a risk of creating the worst case scenario you just laid out?
Well, it depends on what we do between now and then, but that's why this is hard. And I think we've got to be very thoughtful about really answering three questions. What kind of commitment are we willing to make to the Afghan people and the Afghan government? The president and the administration have said that there will be a commitment, but we don't know what. Two, what do we need to do to prevent the rise of terrorist training camps in Afghanistan again? And three, what sort of regional presence do we need? Because the whole region there, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, is unstable. It's destabilizing to many parts of the world. And there are a lot of enemies of the United States there, whether we like it or not. If we can answer those three questions clearly, conclusively for Congress and the American people, then I think we can be very clear about what remaining mission we have in Afghanistan and what we need to do to accomplish it.
So I've been mindful of late of the muscle in the Massachusetts congressional delegation right now. You're speaking very clearly about what you want to see. Congressman Stephen Lynch, who's the Democratic chairman of the House Oversight Committee's National Security Panel, released a statement. I'm going to read you just a piece of it. Quote, "While I certainly share the desire to disengage militarily from Afghanistan, withdrawing all U.S. troops by September still comes with significant risks. Under current conditions, the potential Taliban overthrow of the Afghan government remains a strong possibility. Civil war would seem a virtual certainty," end quote. How much power does the Massachusetts delegation have, and what can it do to make sure that the Biden administration puts in place the three criteria you just talked about?
Well, I think we're in a good position because we have a president who's willing to listen. And I'll never forget, Tiziana, when President Obama was deciding what to do about Iraq, and I frankly disagreed with him. There was one evening when I gave three interviews in a row on TV, CNN, CNN International, maybe Fox or something like that. And just after I finished, I got a call from the White House. And I said, oh, here we go. They didn't like what I said, because I was very critical of the administration. And after they patched me through, someone got on the line and said, "Seth, now I know why I supported you." I'm very proud of you. And I said, wait, did you hear the interview? Are we talking about the same thing? Because I was very critical of the administration. And he said, no, I know you were, but we need your voice. And I appreciate it. And that was Vice President Joe Biden. So I don't think President Biden expects us all to be yes men or yes women here. I think he wants to hear the opinion of people like myself who've fought in the Marine infantry, Steve Lynch, who sat on the committee for a long time. I think that he wants to hear our opinions. And ultimately, he understands that this is a decision that Congress should make. It's the administration's policy in the short term, what we do here. But whether we send Americans to war is written in the Constitution to be Congress's decision. I think we've got to get back to that. And I think Joe Biden agrees.
I am struck that we are having this conversation on the 8th year anniversary of another terror attack on U.S. soil. It's the Boston Marathon bombing, and there are a couple questions I want to ask you about that, but I just want to start by marking the moment with you. How are you? Are you thinking about it? Is it weighing heavily on you today? What are you thinking about it?
I do think about it. I think it's very personal to everyone who comes from Boston or is proud of the city. And it's a reminder that national security threats don't just come from overseas. They come from here at home as well. And one of our responsibilities, those of us who work on our nation's security, is to balance our response to those threats, to make sure that we do what we need to do in places like Afghanistan to prevent another 9/11, but that we don't take our eye off the ball here at home with threats like we saw in the Boston Marathon bombing or what we saw with the insurrection in the Capitol on January 6th.
One of the things, and I almost don't know what to do with this juxtaposition, Congressman, but I'm going to put it out there and ask you to react to it. So it was a massive terrorism attack on U.S. soil on September 11th. Then we have the Marathon bombing. It is a domestic terror attack, but not the same kind of domestic terror that the FBI now says is our biggest terror threat. They say it's domestic violent extremists, and they say that stems from racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists. That is a huge change in a global war on terror and what we might frame as the terrorist threat in 2021. How do we fight our biggest terrorism threats today and counter those?
That's a great question. And from everything I know and the intelligence I've seen, I agree with the FBI's analysis. It doesn't mean the other threats are non-existent. In part, it means that we've just been very effective at dealing with them. But for too long in America, we've ignored the threat of violent extremists, particularly right-wing violent extremists that are so prominent today. Out of political concerns or perhaps racist officials in government, I don't know. We've not taken that threat seriously. And of course, I witnessed it firsthand being at the Capitol on January 6th. I saw violence that day that I never imagined experiencing as a member of Congress in Washington, D.C. I mean, it was the kind of routine you'd see in Iraq or Afghanistan, something I frankly expected in those environments where we were trying to defend a nascent democracy. But the fact that we had to deal with that for the first time in American history, the U.S. Capitol being breached, the fact that we had to deal with that just a few months ago shows how serious this threat is and how many more resources it requires to address.
Just listening to you just now, listening to you talk about your own experience there, do you feel that we are more or less safe today from terrorism threats on our soil than we were 20 years ago when this war started?
I think we're more safe today from a large-scale external threat like we saw in 9/11. And that's thanks to the brave work of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans in uniform, in the intelligence services, in local law enforcement, who continue to work every day to keep us safe. But there's no question that the domestic terror threat maybe not as large scale, maybe not airplanes flying into buildings, but nonetheless, a threat that will kill and maim our fellow citizens. That threat is bigger today than certainly it's ever been in my lifetime, and arguably perhaps bigger than it's been since the Civil War.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents the 6th Congressional District. He served in the Marine Corps and did 4 tours of duty in Iraq. Congressman Moulton, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Is it appropriate to mandate the coronavirus vaccine? Is it legal? And under what circumstances? Everyone is going to be confronting those questions, but universities dove in particularly early. And here in the Commonwealth, Northeastern University moved first. On April 6, they announced all returning students this fall will have to be vaccinated. Since then, Boston University has followed suit, and other colleges around the area are considering a mandate for students. We are joined now by Michael Armini, Senior Vice President for External Affairs at Northeastern University, also the co-chair of the school's COVID-19 task force. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, this is a big move. You guys made it first here in the Commonwealth. Why did you do it, and why did you do it so soon?
Well, the main reason we're requiring the COVID-19 vaccine is the exact same reason that we have long required students to be vaccinated for measles or mumps or meningitis, which is to keep the campus safe. And you have to remember that students are living together, they're eating together, they're participating in athletics and club activities together. So we're talking about a sort of congregate setting, and that kind of a population, you know, at this point, vaccination is the best tool we have to keep that group safe.
So I understand that there is precedent there. We also know there is so much about this pandemic that is unprecedented. Can you take us behind the curtain? Let us know how you guys made the decision. Who was involved? Who did you talk to? What voices were at the table? What did you consider?
Sure. And, you know, for the last, 13 months, we've had a COVID-19 task force, and also the president of the university has his cabinet. And we have made a lot of decisions, probably hundreds or thousands in the last year. On our faculty, we have amazing epidemiologists and infectious disease experts who we've consulted throughout. Once the vaccination process got rolling, both nationwide and here in Massachusetts, we had started thinking about whether we would require it for students. As I can tell, you're hinting at, you know, we had to look at the legal issues. And so we made sure that decision underwent a really thorough legal review. We decided that not only was it the right thing from a public health point of view, but it was consistent with current law. And then we made the announcement, like you said, about a week ago.
The legal issue, as I understand it, is the concern that these are vaccines that are not fully approved. They're just authorized for emergency use. Is that the heart of the legal question?
That is the heart of the question. One of the things that's important to remember is universities such as Northeastern that are engaged in widespread COVID testing on their campuses, all of those testing operations are also under emergency use authorization. So there's a precedent here when you're in a sort of public health emergency that, you know, these steps are warranted. And as I mentioned earlier, this is especially true for college students, because what makes college magical and powerful as a learning experience is the fact that people are together and they're in classrooms and in dorms and in other settings learning from each other. And that same thing that makes it magical and powerful also allows viruses to spread. So that's why we think vaccine is the way to go.
Have you mandated for faculty and staff as well?
No, we are looking at that question. It turns out that with employees, faculty and staff, you're dealing with a whole separate set of legal issues. But of course, the key to keep in mind there is that the faculty and the staff are not all living together in the same residence halls. The other thing I would just add about that is, as of now, just informally, we believe that the faculty and staff here will be vaccinated essentially of their own choosing. In other words, we're not picking up a lot of hesitancy among the faculty and staff. So that may be a problem that doesn't need a solution.
You moved early. And here in the Commonwealth, you guys made this decision first among universities in the Commonwealth. When you got to that point, did the decision trouble you at all? Or from your perspective, by then, was it a no-brainer?
No, we didn't find it troubling at all. We do think it's the right decision. We did give the Baker administration a sort of heads up that we were moving in this direction because we didn't want them to be surprised. And, you know, like you mentioned, they're...
Well, I think we may have just lost Michael Armini. Mr. Armini, do we have you back?
Yes.
Great. We just lost you for a second there.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. Why don't you pick back up about, you know, it was a pretty much a no-brainer decision for you.
Yes, we think it's the right decision to protect the community. You know, like I said before, we do feel that this is the right decision. And as you mentioned, other schools have followed suit.
So I want to give you a hypothetical. I was struck by, there is a requirement for international students. You are also saying that international students must have a vaccine that is authorized for emergency use here in the United States. That really strikes me as an undue hardship. Let's say you're a student in the UK, you are being a good citizen, you get vaccinated with the AstraZeneca vaccine in the UK, and then a week later you find out from Northeastern that you have to be vaccinated to come back. It can't be AstraZeneca. You can't get another shot. What happens?
Yeah, it's a really important question. Today at Northeastern, 18% of our undergraduates are international. To be honest, we're not so worried about the UK or Canada or, you know, countries where vaccination is going well. But there are countries such as India where they're having real challenges. And I think one of the things we're going to have to do is, as we get closer to September, is figure out which students coming from which countries might need to be vaccinated upon entry. In other words, would we be able to essentially administer the vaccine when they arrive? Northeastern is a sort of state-approved vaccine provider. And although the state is not giving doses to universities right now, that could be reinstated over the summer. And that would give us the capacity to make sure those students can matriculate without any problems.
Do you have any concern that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause could affect all of this? Now, obviously, we don't know how long that pause will be in place. But at the same time, we know that a lot of colleges and universities were relying on or thinking they were going to rely on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in particular.
Well, the country is still at about 3 million doses a day, and that's looking really good. And if you kind of look at the federal projections, it's, you know, for an American student, for example, it would be pretty easy to make sure that you're vaccinated sometime this summer. And so, you know, I don't see that as being a particularly sort of definitional issue for us. Now, obviously, if J&J comes back online, that will make things easier. But I think both nationally, and we've heard the governor say here in Massachusetts, that pause shouldn't have a really, you know, sort of material impact on our plan.
What are you hearing from students? I have trouble imagining that this is a universally celebrated decision.
Well, after we announced, we had a lot of positive feedback, particularly from faculty who think this is a good move. Students and their parents have been supportive, but it's really important that when you're making a big policy decision affecting a community with many thousands of people, it will never be totally unanimous. And if you sort of wait till you reach complete unanimity, you'll never make a decision. So, and that's probably one of the biggest lessons of the last 13 months is, you know, we had to make various judgment calls. We had to balance public health against individuals and that, you know, those concerns, but you know, that's part of the process. And overall on this one with the vaccine requirement, it's gone very well.
What are students who are concerned telling you? What are their concerns?
Well, we haven't heard that I know of from students, but we have had a few parents email the university saying that, you know, we don't think this vaccine is safe. I mean, that's a narrative that you've heard out there. And we'll work with them as we would work with any other student or his or her parents, you know, about concerns. This is not the kind of thing where we're going to be doctrinaire and, you know, slam a door on anyone. We'll work with people who have concerns, and hopefully, you know, we won't have a situation where someone just has an absolute refusal.
And if this works, is campus quote unquote normal in the fall, including no masks?
Well, that's a great question. And we've certainly had that as well. I mean, we will comply with CDC and federal and state guidelines on, you know, PPE and other protective measures. But, you know, we want to get as close to normal as we can in the fall. I mean, Students came back to Northeastern this year in droves, and we had about 90% of our students on campus because they want that in-person experience and they want that you know, that college experience. And the goal for next fall is to be as close to that as possible and to be as close to the pre-pandemic experience as possible.
And that is Michael Armini, Senior Vice President for External Affairs at Northeastern University, also the co-chair of the school's COVID-19 task force. Thanks for the time today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It seems safe to say that the world is in a healthcare moment between the focus on the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccination. So, when tech giant Microsoft decided to join the healthcare conversation with its recent acquisition of Nuance Communications, that caught our attention, not just because of the size of the deal, which is $19.7 billion, but also because Nuance Communications is Burlington-based. They focus on artificial intelligence software, think speech recognition, for example. Hiawatha Bray is a technology writer for the business section for the Boston Globe. He joins us now for an update on that acquisition and some other interesting developments in the local tech sector. Welcome back, Hiawatha.
Oh, glad to be here.
So let's start with this acquisition. You wrote that it would make Microsoft pretty much the provider of speech-based artificial intelligence to the world's biggest companies, particularly healthcare, which is big here. What's the impact?
Yeah. I don't know if it'll make them the provider, but it's going to certainly put them in a position to try to become the provider. They really are very interested in healthcare, especially with some of the amazing new services that Nuance has been rolling out in recent years. One of the most interesting is one that Microsoft singled out, and they predict that this one particular service could develop a global market as great as $500 billion. It's an amazing size for a market, and you can see why they want to be into it. And what they're talking about is this technology that Nuance is rolling out that allows a doctor to sit in his office and, in the middle of a consultation, simply talk to the patient. And microphones inside the office are listening to what doctor and patient are saying and generating a complete report on the visit, talking about all the various symptoms that the patient is describing, automatically recognizing possible treatments that the doctor might want to consider, possible drugs that the doctor might want to prescribe, all of this information filed in a logical format so that the doctor only has to review it after the session and then make sure everything is correct and then just file it. Right now, doctors around the world have to sit in front of a computer or hold a clipboard and do all of this by hand, putting everything in the right little areas on the screen or the right checking the right box on a piece of paper. This is piece of software that's supposed to do it all automatically, just two people talking. And not only that, it means you not only could do that in the doctor's office, but now, as we all know, there is a huge move toward telemedicine where people are not even showing up and doing virtual doctor visits. This is perfect for virtual doctor visits. All of the information being exchanged between doctor and patient automatically being recorded, sorted, categorized, possible treatment options automatically suggested by the computer. It's absolutely amazing what they're trying to do, and they're already rolling this technology out. Now, Microsoft, of course, is worldwide.
Wait, I want to ask you a question, though, because in hearing you, I'm picturing this. You're giving a very clear picture of how this is going to work. Are our privacy laws up to snuff on this?
Well, that's not really a challenge for that. I mean, after all, you're already talking about sensitive medical information, which is already covered under the HIPAA privacy laws. You're absolutely right. There are already very strict laws on what can and cannot be done with this data. You're right to raise it, though, because, of course, this will all have to be done in a highly secure way, and it's all going to be happening in the cloud. That's why you've raised a really good point. Microsoft, of course, is the world's second leading cloud provider, Microsoft Azure. So all of this stuff means that all of this technology from Nuance is going to be plugged into the cloud. And so you're right that security for this is going to be very important, but medical stuff is one of the rare areas in American law where there is already, at least on paper, very strict laws about governing the protection of this data. We just have to hope that they actually do it. But this is going to be rolled out in the United States. It's going to be rolled out worldwide. It's going to be cloud-based. And the global market for this is simply gigantic. And that's why it's important for Microsoft to buy it. Because here's the interesting thing. Nuance is a hugely successful company in its field, but they're still just Nuance. They have to go knocking on people's doors trying to get them to buy their products. Microsoft's already there. They supply software to practically everybody on Earth. So Microsoft just says, oh, here's one more new service we can offer. And it's not just for medicine either. They are using, see, Nuance has spent years doing artificial intelligent analysis of voice. And they've got all kinds of new products out there that are going to allow you to do amazing things with it. For example, they've got a product for financial services companies that listens to the person on the phone. If somebody calls trying to pretend to be you, they can not only detect that your voice is wrong, they can figure out from the words you use whether or not you are the person you claim to be. And they've been working on stuff like this for years, so they're going to take some of this technology and sell it to banks, sell it to insurance companies, sell it to all kinds of retail businesses. Nuance has just done amazing work because, you know, just being able to recognize words is artificial intelligence. But nowadays, Apple, Amazon, even Microsoft make products that can do that. Nuance has gotten really good at helping computers understand what the words mean, and this deal is going to let Microsoft spread that all over the world. It could be really, really very profitable for them.
So the profitability, does that come back to Burlington? Does it create more jobs here?
I think it has to, because one of the reasons that it happened here is because Burlington and Boston in general has been a key area for the development of speech recognition technologies and artificial intelligence built around it. I mean, a lot of the work for Alexa was done around here, too. We have a lot of the best people in the world working on that field here in the Boston area. So, yeah, I think this is very good news. You know, it's depressing, though, because we're never anymore. You know, it's been decades since the Boston area was a home base to companies that did this kind of stuff. Nowadays, we create these companies, and then some giant like Google or Microsoft or somebody else comes in and buys them. Or Amazon, which, of course, came in and bought our great robot manufacturer for industrial robots or warehouse robots. That's been a good news, bad news thing. But it's kind of annoying to have the giants come in and buy these great companies instead of them becoming giants for us.
All right, so Hiawatha, we've got about just a couple minutes left. Let's talk about warehouse robots, because you want to talk a little bit about a new robot from Boston Dynamics.
Yeah, I actually want to mention two new robots, because this is really weird. You know Boston Dynamics, they got the robots with the walking around on the four legs. They were created as a military company designing robots for military use, and they're all very cool-looking and sexy. They have just gone into the unsexiest branch of the robotics business, which is robots for loading and unloading trucks in a warehouse. This new product of theirs is called Stretch, and it's a really major shift in emphasis for Boston Dynamics, but it's perfectly obvious why. It sounds so boring compared to what these guys usually make, like the dancing robots we've all seen on those YouTube videos. But warehouse robotics may be boring. They're insanely profitable, or at least they are expected to be. It's believed that in 10 years, companies are going to be buying $50 billion of these things every year. And Boston Dynamics has decided they want to be in that business, and they're right to be in it. Every warehouse in the world is going to need these things. And their move into that market could be extremely lucrative for them. I also wanted to mention,
but people will lose jobs, right?
Not really. That's the interesting thing about working in warehouses. They can't keep workers. People hate working in warehouses. This is one kind of a robotic application where it's probably not going to cost a lot of jobs because most people don't want to do this work anyhow. But the other thing I
want to mention is robot?
Another company, spinoff of MIT, that is also just announced that they're making the same kind of robot, only they say theirs is better at picking up all kinds of different sized objects, boxes, small, large, different sizes, different shapes. Theirs is called Dill, and the company is called Pickle. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I've been talking to them. They're MIT guys. They're not joking.
Sorry.
And they've actually built this robot. It's the Dill robot from Pickle, and it is designed to go into the back of a truck and unload the truck. And again, it sounds insanely boring. But this is actually an incredibly hard problem for robots to figure out how to grab a little box and then a big box and then a medium-sized box. It's incredibly difficult, and they think they figured out how to do it. And again, there's a huge market for this. So, yeah, these are both areas where the Boston area is actually sitting pretty. We're really, right now, we're the world center of warehouse robotics. We got about five or six different companies building robots for warehouses, and it's boring, but it's very profitable.
And again, those profits, they can come back and help grow our jobs, our workforce base here.
That's the goal. Absolutely.
All right. That is Hiawatha Bray, business and technology reporter for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, every time you come on, I think, oh, I just love talking to this guy. We have to have him on more. So I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Ask me anytime. Okay.
Have you ever thought about the relationship between beauty and justice? You got to sit with that for a minute. But the idea that we can pair what's right with what is beautiful really is something. Back in October, we discussed this idea with Michael Murphy. He's the founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group, a nonprofit architecture firm focused on buildings for underserved populations. That conversation was right around the time that Mass Design Group's new book, Justice is Beauty, came out. The book chronicles projects done by the group that tie justice and beauty together, such as a hospital on a terraced hillside in Rwanda that reduces the spread of disease, a cholera treatment center in Haiti which treats its own water, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, commemorating victims of lynching in the United States. When we spoke to Michael, he told us how in early 2020, he'd already begun drawing connections between the pandemic and justice in design.
For me, it was really the first week of March. I was just coming back from family leave. My son was born in late January, and my first trip was a flight to Los Angeles to give a lecture, and we were just starting to hear about the pandemic to our shores. And I remember flying to LA, being worried about the infection, and knowing that there was that airflow could be a primary mode of transmission. And in the 3 days I was there, coming back through LAX and flying back to Boston, being the only one with a mask on, sitting in the plane, very, very concerned about transmission, and having this real flashback to my time working in Rwanda in wards. Where tuberculosis, the airborne disease or multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, was transmitted in hallways and in other spaces, and being very afraid of contamination. And it clicked at that moment, you know, that it wasn't just hospitals where diseases are transferred. It wasn't just spaces that we know there's infections, but all the spaces around us, our houses, our schools, of course, our hospitals, our airports, are contagious if there is something in the air that can contaminate us, and that breathing is really a spatial problem, and our access to fresh air is a problem mitigated by the buildings around us.
Okay, that's terrifying. And in listening to you say it, I almost feel kind of short of breath. What did you do when you got home? How have you been working with that idea since March, when this revelation hit you on the airplane?
Well, I think it is terrifying, but it's also empowering. I mean, I think all of us in the world right now are going through a very similar spatial awakening. You know, we're looking at the walls around us and realizing that these systems that are supposed to introduce fresh air are not working as effectively as they could. Could we open windows? Could we protect our families in more effective ways? And that spatial awakening, I think, is a really profound shift in the way we think about our world. And because it gives us access to tools that we can change the buildings around us, change our ventilation systems, and change the way we understand air as a contaminating agent or a healing agent. And that's not just about the coronavirus. You start to think about air being contaminated with off-gassing or emissions or smoke, like we saw in the fires in California. Of course, carbon emitted into the atmosphere affecting neighborhoods, you know, and our climate, these are all issues related to our ability to be around fresh air.
So let's begin to tie this now, Michael, to the thesis of this book, the manifesto, as I read it, from Mass Design Group, that justice is beauty. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of the book. Our producer Zoe found this paragraph, and I remember when I read it, when I was reading the book, it struck me, especially in this context. It's on page 16, and it has to do with when you were building the cholera hospital in Haiti after a major outbreak there. Maybe you can read that for us.
Sure. It sometimes takes a disaster to reveal the fraying threads that undermine the social fabric of a community. In December 2011, cholera was that tear, uncovering the true infrastructural vulnerabilities of a country with so much of its building stock broken to begin with. The outbreak also revealed that it was not a lack of medical care or drugs or good intentions that paved Haiti's road to hell, but the very real and alarmingly limited number of working wastewater pipes that lay beneath it. What enabled cholera and crippled Haiti was a complete failure of the built environment.
Of course, hearing you right there about the fraying threads, the infrastructure vulnerabilities, the disproportionate impact that that had on the poor and vulnerable in Port-au-Prince, for example, really brings home the data we consistently hear about the coronavirus and its disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations, people of color, low-income families. How do we begin to think about here this realization about our weakened infrastructure, of the vulnerabilities it creates, and what we can do different in our built environment? How do we begin to connect these dots?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, these epidemics, these challenges really stress our systems, and they reveal the cracks in those systems. We often say buildings heal or hurt. And here's an example of where we're seeing the built environment around us really hurt our public, the people most affected by the coronavirus. Of course, we're all affected by the coronavirus, but those most disproportionately affected are communities of color, but especially folks living in conditions like nursing homes, senior housing, incarcerated individuals, those within structures where they are most disenfranchised and unable to control the environment around them effectively. And this is a real concern that we should have, not just in addressing the kind of structural injustices in our community and advocating for those who are having trouble advocating for themselves in these conditions, but also thinking about the built environment that is encasing them, that they're suffering within. Can we redesign senior housing to breathe better, to be more effective, to be healing? Obviously, questions of incarceration surround us every day. We have to not just decarcerate our problem of mass incarceration, but think critically about spaces of detention, if we have them at all, and about how they're affecting people's health and their ability to live. All of these questions are interrelated with the buildings around us. And so designing spaces that are healing is about thinking about our physiological health, our sociological health, and also our environmental health.
All right, so now with these spaces that are healing, you've taken us to the justice part. So now take us the next step to the beauty part, and maybe give us a story or a specific example from one of your designs.
You know, I think we have this, there's this misunderstanding, I believe, in the way we evaluate buildings around us. And we often talk about buildings as beautiful or sometimes ugly. Often, a lot of times, we talk about them as ugly. Or we talk about them as effective systems, good housing or poor housing. And we don't often talk about those things as interrelated, and that the choice between one or the others we really have found is a false choice. You know, all buildings affect our social, our environmental, and our political systems. The question is whether we really acknowledge that or not, and then are designing those systems to serve the public that they're in most effectively. And if we do so, this creates beauty, not just the form that we see, but the beauty is the perfect or the successful resolution of all of these systems coming together and serving the public in its most effective form. I really learned about this working in Rwanda with Dr. Paul Farmer, the great humanitarian designer. I'd call him really an architect himself and my first mentor of architecture. You know, and he talked about designing hospitals and building hospitals around the world, and he always focused on, this is a funny story, but he always would focus on the fish pond. It was always important that each medical facility had a fish pond. I always wondered why. He said to me once, you know, actually at the time, the Minister of Health of Mexico, Julio Frank, who ended up being the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, came to one of these facilities, and he came in, he saw the trees that Paul had spent so much time planting and the gardens and the fish pond, and he pronounced dignificación. This is the creation of dignity, the commitment and care to not just a facility that treats those with poor health or need treatment, but those that care about their whole being and their whole selves and creates beauty for them to repair in those spaces. That's a fundamental thing that the built environment is offering us at all times or taking away from us. And we should really focus on both of those things at once.
And just to note, you may have mentioned this, but Paul Farmer is the founder of Partners in Health, which I think was begun as a local organization here in the area. We have just a little bit of time left, Michael. Many of the spaces that Mass Design Group creates are communal, And you talk a lot about that in the book, Justice is Beauty. But we are now in a time when communal spaces have become not only almost irrelevant, but obsolete or anathema, at least for a while. What does that mean? And what does it mean for your work?
You know, I think, you know, what you're talking about is really the public realm. And it's such an important thing for us to really think about right now, because the public realm is changing. It's changing in front of us, changing beneath our feet. It's shifting, but it's not going away. I wouldn't say it's being eradicated or erased. It's just changing. We're both seeing public realms that are being taken away from us. Let's say the restaurant, for example, is a form of public realm that few of us are going into. Of course, the theater or collective cultural spaces. But we're also seeing new public realms emerge. You know, the restaurant going out into the street and taking over new spaces that are providing that public realm again, where it's so necessary for us to gather. And we're seeing how essential it is for us as a public to gather, and how desperate we are to find that connection. I certainly feel it all the time, you know, staring at Zoom calls or on the computer, that we're not able to connect with each individuals in front of us, you know, see their muscles in their face change as we have a dialogue, or see them in person, or get to do things together. These are all, we're kind of like suffering in this isolation, and I think there's a desperate need for connectivity again. Now, one of the things I think the public realm forces us to do is consider who we are as a public and how we come together. You think about the Boston Common, for example, one of the great public realms in our country, and really one of the first public spaces is defined by that. And it's a very definition, the common, where our common needs and our common services are brought together and shared and navigated together under a shared collective needs and collective rights. This is essential for us as a public to sort of define ourselves and come together to advocate for what we need.
That was Michael Murphy, the founding principal and executive director of Mass Design Group. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.